Welcome to Wall Street Unspun with your host, Peter Schiff.
But it's a giant bubble in search of a pin, and it's going to find
one. Are you confused with the ups and downs of the economy and what it means to you?
Don't believe the propaganda, and that's what it is. When you're listening to an analyst on a lot of these popular financial shows, you're not getting investment advice. You're getting propaganda.
Get ready to untangle the web of misinformation provided by the mainstream media.
These firms are trying to sell you stocks. Their real clients, their banking clients, are trying to get rid of stocks.
And now, here's your host of Wall Street Unspun, the president of Euro Pacific Capital and a licensed broker with a passion for truth. It's Wall Street Unspun with Peter Schiff.
Hi, everybody. Welcome again this November 4th for another live episode of Wall Street Unspun Midweek Market Update. I'm taking your calls live, 888-678-9597, 888-678-9597, as I do every Wednesday evening, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific, on my website, www.europac.net, on shortwave radio, 5.07 megahertz. Again, 888-678-9597. Not sure how many live listeners I'm going to have today, seeing that I am competing with Game 6 of the World Series. Certainly in the New York area, Philadelphia area, we probably won't have many listeners. But anyway, hopefully a lot of the people who can't hear me live will be able to get the archives, go to the podcasts, or the various places. We put these broadcasts now up on my YouTube page, Schiff Report. So you got the archives on Europac website. You got them as podcast archives. You got them on YouTube. So there's plenty of places if you happen to miss the live episode where you can listen to it. And if you hear something in particular that you think is interesting and you want your friends to listen to it, again, refer them to one of the many ways that they can hear this show archived on the Internet. First announcement, I will be appearing on the Glenn Beck Show tomorrow on Thursday. His show is live from 5 to 6 p.m. Glenn's not going to be there, which maybe is the reason that I've been invited. I don't know. I used to be on his show a lot when he was on CNN, not too often on Fox. But I got a call from Judge Napolitano, who I know very well. I'm on his show on Fox.com, Freedom Watch. Hopefully one day that show is going to become a Fox News regular show. But I did his show today. If you haven't watched that, it's on the Internet on Fox.com. He does Freedom Watch. It used to be once a week every Wednesday for an hour. Now it's five times a week for a half hour. So the show is making more headway on the Internet. But if you haven't watched it, try to check it out. But Judge Napolitano is going to be hosting or sitting in for Glenn Beck tomorrow. And so he asked me to be on the show. So I will be on the show live in studio with the judge on Fox News tomorrow. Also, another announcement. At midnight tonight, Eastern Time, begins the money bomb, the first real money bomb of the Schiff for Senate campaign. And I would encourage everybody who has donated to donate some more. And if you haven't donated, this is the time to do it. Start midnight tonight so we can get a money bomb. And hopefully, if we raise enough money, try to go to the media and let them see what a real candidate who has real ideas and who really wants to bring meaningful change to the country, how much grassroots support we can really get. Remember, I'm up in my primary against four opponents. You've got one of them who is a mainstream, a former three-term congressman who's got all the backing of the Republican establishment and all the fundraising that they can do. I've also got two very wealthy people, one extremely wealthy in Linda McMahon, who's saying she's going to spend now upwards of $50 million of her own money on this campaign, as well as a very wealthy Tom Foley. So there's a lot of people, a lot of money, a lot of ties. Tom Foley is a big fundraiser for George Bush. He's really tapped in to the Republican fundraising machine. He raised so much money for George Bush that he made him the ambassador to Ireland. So I don't have any of those connections. I need to raise my money from real Americans, from grassroots, from the mom and pops, average everyday Americans. And, you know, hopefully we can show that when we pull together and when we have a cause worth fighting for, that average Americans can fund a political campaign. And so here's your chance to show that we can do that with this money bomb. And I also want to mention, a lot of people think that I'm not really in this race because they haven't really seen me doing much in the last month or so since my announcement. Believe me, behind the scenes, I've been doing a lot. I've deliberately tried to fly below the radar just so people will underestimate me. But I have been building a campaign team. I have also been building a brand new website, which is going to premiere sometime today or by tomorrow morning. So if you go to shiftforsenate.com, you'll see a much sharper, much nicer, more professional website. I am also in the process of building out a program for the volunteers to use. And I need as many volunteers as I can, and go to shiftforsenate.com. If you volunteered a few months ago and you're wondering why we haven't called you, it's because the system's not ready yet. But once it's ready, we're going to contact the thousands of people that have already volunteered. We need more. I'd like to get 10 to 20,000 volunteers. And I would love it if everybody can give me an hour a day of their time. And I promise it'll be worthwhile. We're going to make it fun. There's going to be a lot of feedback. It'll be kind of like a game. You can, be entertained while you're helping me to raise my name and my profile in the state of Connecticut, helping me to fundraise and helping to, to take back America. You know, I am very, I think it's a good sign what happened in the elections yesterday. I think there were a lot of people that came out to vote against Barack Obama. You had, Republicans winning two governor contests against the Democrats, despite President Obama campaigning heavily, which I think is the beginning of the backlash against big government, more government. People are starting to get a belly full of this nonsense, and they don't want to be spoon-fed the rhetoric anymore. I think the voters are ready for a real change, a candidate that it means what he says and says what he means, and somebody with some fresh ideas and a new perspective to come outside the political sphere. I think the time is right for us and for a candidate like me. And let's get started with this money bomb. Let's really bring this campaign, into another gear. I've been scheduling appointments like crazy. My calendar, starting in a week or so, is booked nonstop with events here in Connecticut. We also are going to start doing the traditional mailings. I've already bought the addresses and the names, so we're going to start bombarding the state with literature regarding my campaign. Right now, there's not even that many people in Connecticut who even know I'm running. Although in the last week, I did make two television appearances on local television on the CBS affiliate. I did Face the State, and I made an appearance on a Fox local affiliate for Connecticut, Fox 30. So I'm starting to do some local television. I think my name is starting to get out there, but it's going to get out there a lot more, especially if the people listening to this radio show really step up to the plate, volunteer their time, and volunteer their money. In particular, make a donation after midnight tonight, anytime tomorrow, at shiftforsenate.com. For the money bomb that has been hosted by a group that put up a website, shiftsuperbomb.com. So if you visit that website, you'll see the guys that have organized the Shift money bomb. And also, they're not taking anything. Some people, there's no fees attached. They're not charging me, a percentage of what I raise. There's nothing in it for them. 100% of what you donate in the money bomb goes to the Shift campaign. Nothing is coming out for anybody who is promoting this money bomb. Anyway, first of all, on the news since the last show, I think the biggest news by far is the 200 metric ton purchase of gold by the Central Bank of India from the IMF. Now, if you remember months ago when it was first mentioned that the IMF was going to be selling all this gold, I said not to worry. There were people who were saying that this is negative for gold, that this is a big supply, the selling is going to suppress the market. I said not a chance. I said there were plenty of foreign central banks that would love to get their hands on IMF gold, and the IMF would have no trouble finding large buyers from foreign central banks, and that's exactly what happened. And I think the IMF is stupid for selling this gold. They should hold on to it, and the fact that they're selling it is a great opportunity for India, who bought it I'm sure China is feeling the pressure that they need to buy more. You know, India, even with this purchase, their reserves are only 7% in gold. So they're 93% in paper, mainly dollars, only 7% in real money. In China, even though China has more gold reserves than India, their reserves are only 1.5% gold. They are loaded up with paper. They need to buy gold in a big, big way over there in China. I don't know why how they let this these 200 metric tons slip beneath their fingers into India. If I was China, I would have made a bid for the of IMF gold, and I would have paid a premium to get it. But we'll see which foreign central bank, whether it's China, whether it's Brazil, whether it's Russia. You know, these emerging market economies, these developed, they are so underweighted in gold right now, and they are flush with rapidly depreciating paper dollars. And we know they're going to keep depreciating. Ben Bernanke came out today and announced that, guess what? Interest rates are staying at zero indefinitely. That's basically the call from the Fed. Even though they think the economy is improving, they still think that it's so weak that interest rates have to be zero in order for it to not collapse, which is, you know, an amazing statement in and of itself. The dollar was down once again. And, of course, the price of gold on the news that India bought was up, I think, $25 an ounce that day, $30 or so. It was up again today. It's at new record highs. We're almost at $1,100 an ounce on the price of gold. And if you look at the Dow priced in gold, the Dow continues to fall. The Dow is now just worth a little more than 9 ounces of gold. The Dow was worth 10 ounces of gold just a few weeks ago. So that's a 10% drop in the real value of the U.S. stock market. Even though you don't see it in a nominal sense, I think we're headed back down to 8-to-1 relatively soon. And by next year, I expect the Dow to be worth just 5 ounces of gold. I don't know exactly where the two are going to be. It could be Dow 10,000, gold 2,000, right? Or it could be Dow 8,000. And then gold would only have to go to 1,600 or some, or not 8,000 or whatever times, you know, not 1,600, but you do the math. But, you know, it's going to happen. And, you know, I would just continue to buy the precious metals. Keep buying gold. Keep buying silver. I mean, silver is trading well. Silver hasn't even made a new high yet. But I think the charts look extremely bullish for both gold and silver. You know, I commented on my video blog, and if you're not watching that, I do these video blogs. Sometimes I do them daily right now on my website on YouTube. But I commented on Friday because it seemed to me that gold was very strong that day. Even though the Dow was down about 250 points intraday, gold recouped a $10 loss and closed flat on the day. That, to me, that day showed some underlying resilience in the price of gold. And boy, you know, ever since that day, we've had Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, I think we're up $10 on Monday, $30, another $5, you know. So we've had three solid up days in a row ever since that recovery. But even though gold is at new highs, silver has still not taken out even its highs from a few weeks ago. And the gold and silver stocks, if you look at the Huey Index, the HUI, that's well off its highs of this move, let alone the highs from 2008. I mean, back in 2008, in March of 2008, when gold barely touched 1,000 and then pulled back, that Huey Index got to 520. Now we're almost 10% above 1,000, and the Huey's 100 points lower. So I think gold stocks still offer a lot of value. Again, if you're interested in these types of stocks, I got a new research report that's coming out soon about my five favorite gold stocks to buy. But if you're interested in finding out which stocks I like, finding out they're suitable for you, make sure to contact your broker at Euro Pacific Capital. Give them a call, 800-727-7922, 800-727-7922, to talk about the gold stocks I like or any other foreign stocks I like if you want to get in on the gold move. Also, the physical bullion, I still strongly recommend that people have physical gold. We've been selling gold through the Perth Mint. I think it's a great way to have gold and silver and have it offshore. Again, call us at 800-993-8350, 800-993-8350 to learn about the Perth Mint and holding gold through their certificate program in Australia. Also, what else? I happened to speak today at a commodity conference on the New York Stock Exchange or the New York Stock Exchange, and then I actually did a hit on Fox Business, live from the floor. But I spoke. The interesting before I spoke, Mario Rubini spoke, and I got to hear the tail end of his presentation. And you know, he wrote an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal about the mother of all carry trades in the U.S. dollar. And a number of people emailed me asking me to comment on what he had to say. And I disagree with much of what Rubini is saying. Basically, his position is that there's a giant worldwide global bubble funded by the dollar carry trade, that everybody is borrowing in dollars and leveraging up and buying what he says are risky assets. And he says that since the dollar can't drop forever, at some point we're going to have a sharp rise in the dollar, and then everybody's going to have to cover these trades, and the global markets are going to come crashing down. Well, I think the event that Mira Rubini is describing already happened in 2008. I do not think you're going to see that liquidity-driven flight to the dollar, global synchronized sell-off, happen twice in a row. I think the odds of that are slim, and I think Rubini is making several mistakes in his analysis. First of all, he's assuming that let me backtrack. First of all, Rubini assumes that the dollar is the safe asset, and that all the other things that people are buying, like gold, like silver, like commodities, like stocks and real businesses, that those are the risky assets. And he thinks people are taking a lot of risk in the investments that they're making. See, I think he's got it backwards. I think they're fleeing risk. I think people are buying gold because they're afraid of the dollar. I think people are buying commodities because they're afraid of the dollar. They're trying to escape risk because they understand where the risk is. The risk is in holding a currency that is being printed into oblivion. That's the risk. So the fact that people don't want dollars and want other assets isn't a sign of risk-taking, it's a sign of risk aversion. That's number one. Number two, he's assuming that all the people buying gold or all the people buying stocks are leveraged, that they're all doing it with borrowed money. Well, that's nonsense. The vast majority are not. Look, I've got 10 to 15,000 clients at Euro Pacific Capital. We're buying foreign stocks. We're buying gold. We're not doing it with borrowed money. We're not on leverage. We're not going to have a giant margin call if for some reason the dollar were to go up. And I think that's the case in most parts of the world. There are real buyers here. This is not speculative money. This is not just hedge funds that are leveraged up. There is real money coming in. Look, when the Bank of India just bought 200 metric tons of gold, they didn't do it on margin. This is a real purchase with real money, and this is going on all around the world. That's another thing that he misses. Number three, he's talking about this huge rise we've had in global stock prices, which he looks at as a bubble. But he's not looking at the complete context of where these stock prices are rising from. Many of these stocks in Asia were down 70, 80, 90% in a six-month period in 2008. The fact that these stocks have moved up so dramatically in the last year, in most cases, they haven't even returned to the prices where they were a year ago when they went down by amounts that was completely unwarranted. You had a fire sale on these assets. There was this credit crunch. They were throwing them out the window. They never should have got that cheap. The fact that they've now risen so much doesn't mean that now we have a bubble, right? If a stock, you know, goes from $10 a share to $1, and then it goes back to 5 or 6 to say, well, it's a bubble because it's gone up 5 or 6-fold, you're missing the fact that it dropped 90% before it did that for no real reason, right? So in most cases, these stocks are simply recovery ground they never should have lost in the first place, because I think the people that were selling these stocks didn't understand the fundamentals, and in many cases, the sales had nothing to do with the fundamentals. They had to do with liquidity. They had to do with the need for cash when nobody had any. So most of the stocks that I look at are not trading at bubble valuations, period. Another thing he's talking about is the dollar carry trade. Yes, the dollar carry trade is there. I don't know how many people are pursuing it because you know what? It's brand new. The yen carry trade lasted over a decade. Who knows how long the dollar carry trade is going to last, because you know what? It's a better trade than the yen carry trade because the yen fundamentally was a strong currency. The dollar is a disaster. I think that the dollar carry trade will be here a lot longer and be far more profitable than the yen carry trade ever was. So even if Rubini is right to the extent of there being a dollar carry trade, it's just started. It could be here. So if there is going to be a blow up eventually, it could be 5, 10, 20 years. Who knows? Because I think the dollar carry trade is going to be here a long time. And then the last thing is Miri Rubini is still very bearish on the global economy because he doesn't understand the decoupling. He really doesn't understand the real difference between how real wealth is created. He doesn't have that big picture correctly. So he doesn't see how, you know, the global economy can do well, even though he still believes that we're going to have a double dip or a U-shaped recovery. So he doesn't understand how the world separates itself from our problems. I do. He doesn't. And I also don't think he's even bearish enough. So I think where Rubini is getting it wrong is he's too bearish on the global market, but he's not bearish enough on the U.S. economy. And so I think that's causing him to make the wrong decision. I mean, he's certainly been better than most of the people that the mainstream listens to, although they certainly didn't listen to him at all when he was predicting a recession and a bad housing market, just like no one listened to me. But right now, I think he's saying some things that are not, you know, exactly what I agree with. And, you know, I'm pretty sure that the facts are going to bear me out on this one. You know, talking about, you know, people predicting the economic crisis, and I'll take your calls momentarily. But, you know, I was watching CNBC, and this really, you know, irks me, gets under my skin when this happened. Because I know it happened, you know, now Charlie Gasparino, and, you know, I got nothing against Charlie. I mean, and this is not against these guys. And there was, he wrote a book that just came out. I think it's number 15 now on Amazon. They said it was about the financial crisis and the meltdown on Wall Street. And, of course, you know, I think he got a good review in the Wall Street Journal. Another guy, David Faber, nice guy, about the roof caved in. And so you've got all these guys on CNBC now writing books about the financial crisis and why it happened, right? And when they write them, here you have them. He was on Larry Kudlow. And Larry Kudlow is like, he's like, you know, lavishing him with praise for writing this book about explaining how the government had a role, how the Federal Reserve had a role, how money was too easy, how, you know, Fannie, all the things that I was basically trying to tell him and tell his viewers and his guests in 2006 and 2007, and I got nothing but laughter. But all of a sudden, he's acting like he never heard this stuff, right? He's hearing it from Gasparino after the fact. I told it to him before it happened, just completely dismissed it. Now, of course, you know, this book gets reviewed. His book gets reviewed by the Wall Street Journal. Crash Proof was never reviewed by anybody. Nobody reviewed Crash Proof. Nobody reviewed Crash Proof 2.0. I mean, you would think that the media would want to give more credit to somebody who wrote the predictions before they happened. Anybody can write a book after the fact. Especially what bothers me, these guys on CNBC, when they write these books and they blame everybody but themselves. They blame Wall Street. They blame the government. What about their role as financial journalists? What about the fact that all this happened right under their nose, and they didn't say anything about it? And what about the fact that when somebody did come on their air and try to expose it, you know, they laughed at them, they snickered at them. And the interesting thing is, and I, you know, I was on CNBC today. I was on what you call Fast Money. And they've been calling me every week now because the producer basically told me that whenever I'm on his show, they get the most ratings ever. And so they want me on the show because I'm a ratings machine. But, you know, I never used to do Fast Money in 06 and 07. The shows I used to do a lot, you know, never have me on. That's the thing that kind of, it's where I was on Fox, on those Fox Saturday shows I used to be on all the time. I used to be on Kudlow quite a bit. I used to be on some of the Squawk Box shows a lot. The shows that I used to be on the most in 2006 and 2007, those are the shows that barely have me on, you know. So they want to congratulate these guys that are writing these books, you know, after the fact, when it's obvious what happened, it's all laid out, but they don't want to bring on the guy that was on their air telling them what was going to happen and say, you know what, Peter, you were right. Gee, you know, we really owe you an apology on this one. You were out here. You tried to warn us. You laid it out. You hit the nail on the head. You were 100% right. No, no one has ever said that. And meanwhile, you know, the guys who were wrong, you know, they're on like they never got anything wrong. They're still treating with as much respect now as they did then. Anyway, it's, you know, it's just one of those things that never fails to irk me. You know, but, you know, I know that you guys, I know the people that listen to this radio show. I mean, I don't need the credit, right? I mean, you know, I know what I got right and I know what I got wrong. And, you know, I don't need, you know, people in the media to validate it. But it's just an interesting thing to point out. Anyway, let me go to the calls. First caller is Sam in Pennsylvania.
Oh, hi. Hi, Peter. Hello.
Hey, Sam. How are you?
Oh, good. How are you? Appreciate your message, and I am a contributor to your campaign. Good luck.
Thank you.
I was wondering if you think there's anything on the horizon as far as technology, for example, mass production of the electric car, which would impact the price of oil and subsequently the dollar.
Well, you know, obviously, you know, 100 years from now, I don't think we're going to be, you know, putting gasoline in our cars and driving them, right? I think that, you know, sometime between now and then, we will find a more efficient way to generate power. But, you know, for the next 5 or 10 years or even 20 years, I don't think there's going to be a significant change. I think we're still going to be driving, cars that run on gasoline, you know, that, and we're still going to be, you know, heating our homes that are the same way, or, you know, so I don't see anything like that happening immediately. But if it did, if some, you know, somebody just, discovered a pill that you can put in seawater and would turn it into gasoline, right? If we could just do that, if someone just came up with that, I think that would help every economy. It would help the U.S. economy. It would help every economy except probably, you know, the economies that are major exporters of oil, like, you know, the Middle East.
Okay. Okay, thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot, Sam. Next up is Tom in New York. Tom, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Hey, you're live with Peter Schiff.
Hi, Peter. How are you?
Good.
Hey, calling about gold and silver. I own some bullion of both, and I'm thinking about buying some of the ETFs that are publicly traded, and just wanted to get your thoughts on that.
On whether you should own the ETFs?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, look, I mean, the ETFs, we own them for some of our clients. I mean, certainly, the only real risk in the ETFs, other than government confiscation down the line, which, of course, they'd be able to confiscate that gold as well if they did it, mm-hmm. is the potential for an accounting fraud. That's all. I mean, I don't know. There's auditors. They have to have gold behind the shares that are issued.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's always the chance that they don't have all the gold that they claim to have. And maybe the auditors, didn't pick that up. I don't know. I don't know how significant that risk is, but that's about the only thing I can think of that could potentially be a problem.
Okay. Okay. And with the gold going so high, it's reaching its all-time highs recently, do you think it's anything to do with any maybe speculation, like maybe with some major hedge funds? Or do you think it's
I think there are some hedge funds that are buying gold. I mean, it's some of the smartest hedge fund managers out there. The guys that kind of got the mortgage trades right, the guys that got the banks right, they're all piling into gold now. So it seems like the people that understand what's going on understand the big picture. And if you understand the big picture, you're buying gold. But I don't even think gold is that high right now. Look, you figure it closing in on $1,100 an ounce. But given all the currency that has been printed and all the currency that's going to be printed in the years ahead,
mm-hmm.
gold's still cheap.
Yeah.
It's amazing. You know, while I was on the New York Stock Exchange, I popped in on the guys at CNBC, on a couple of guys. And unfortunately, I couldn't do the show because, you know, they tried to get me to go on air. But I had told Fox that I was going to be exclusive to them that day, the Fox Business. So I couldn't go on. But I talked to Mark Haynes. And again, I'm joking with Mark. I always tease Mark. And Mark, before I came in, Mark said, well, imagine, he's talking about gold. He said, imagine if you bought gold 5 years ago. And I said, Mark, you wouldn't have to imagine it if you just followed my advice. I was on television 5 years ago. I told you to buy it. And I told you to buy into 300. You didn't do it. You laughed at me. You said, who needs gold? Who cares about gold? Well, here it is, $1,100 an ounce. You know, you want to buy it.
Mm-hmm.
And, they still don't seem to get what's going on. And, you know, they look at it and they think it's expensive. It's not. It's, people are going to look back, I think, at $1,000 the way they used to look at gold, the Dow Jones at 1,000. You know, for a long time, people thought 1,000 on the Dow was expensive. And for a while, it was. But obviously, we're well above that now. I think the same thing's going to happen with gold.
Think there'll be any correction?
There'll always be corrections. The question is trying to figure out when they are. I don't know. Personally, to me, it looks like we've just broken out. And while, you know, in the past we've seen these false breakouts, every, you know, and corrections, you know, you always got to be prepared that there could be a bigger correction. But given what the charts look like to me, and given the fact that we still haven't seen new highs in the stocks, personally, I think the next big correction in gold, if I was going to guess, I would wait for a new high in silver and a new high in HUI. So let the gold stocks make a new high. We still got almost 100 points up there. We still need silver to be over $20 an ounce and gold rising. So let everything confirm. Let everything make a new high, and then people will say, aha, this is it. Now we have confirmation. Now let's buy, and that might sucker in enough short-term hot money that we can have a meaningful correction to flush those people out. But personally, I don't think we're going to have a meaningful correction until that happens. That's my guess.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Tom. Next up, looks like, is Jim in California. Jim, you there?
Yeah, hi.
Hey, Jim, how are you?
Hi, how's it going?
Good.
I wanted to ask you about real estate prices. You know, going back to your 2006, your legendary mortgage brokers conference, that was great, by the way. I can watch that like 10 times.
Thank you.
You talk about a 70, I'm forgetting the exact number, but something like a 70% correction, 80, something like that. And we've only seen about a 40%. So, and I've been scouring your writings and your speeches for something on this lately. My first question is, what do you think, is the future for real estate prices, especially in lieu of what you just said about, interest rates not going up. I mean, I know they're all overvalued, but if these rates stay where they are, does that...
Yeah, I mean, first of all, my forecast of a 70-80%, when I was talking about those numbers, I wasn't talking about nationwide averages. I was always saying, you know, I thought that real estate on a national level would go down 30% or more. When I was talking about 60-80%, I'm talking about, you know, individual properties in foreclosures and forced sales, that there would be examples of properties dropping by 70-80%. But I didn't mean that the entire real estate market was going to drop by that much, but that there were going to be individual homes that somebody bought for, you know, $1 million that sold in foreclosure for $200,000. But I was not referring to, you know, general prices in arm's length transactions, but just what the worst examples would be in the meltdown. But in general, I was forecasting about a 30% decline nationwide and about a 50% decline in real estate prices in the bubble states like California, you know, Arizona, Nevada, Florida. And by and large, that's happened. And I think that, you know, we have seen some of the, you know, prices down more than 50%. But I think the reason that we haven't seen more of the 70-80% or more drops is because of all the government supports that have basically kept the foreclosures at bay, that I didn't necessarily forecast. All the moratoriums on foreclosures, the government not only taking over Freddie and Fannie, but empowering FHA to buy all these loans and the tax credits for home buyers, and all the artificial supports that have kind of kept a lot of the foreclosures from hitting the market. So we haven't seen as dramatic a decline. But because of what they're doing and because of all the money they're printing, I believe that the real decline in real estate prices will now be even greater, as far as the nationwide, the median price decline will be even greater in real terms. And when I say real terms, I mean the price of gold. So, you know, right now gold is at $1,100 an ounce. You know, when real estate, you know, in 2000, when gold was, you know, $250 an ounce, gold prices, you know, have gone up dramatically, which means that houses, in terms of the price of gold, have declined dramatically. So if somebody were to sell their house today, they won't get anywhere near as much gold as they would have got if they sold it a few years ago. The other way of it, way to look at it is, if you own gold, you can buy a lot more house for your ounces, and that's going to continue. Because in order to keep these nominal home prices artificially elevated, they only do that by cheapening the dollar. And you can see that when you look at home prices and you measure them in gold.
So where do you think we go from here 5 years out? Do they continue dropping, or are they just going to artificially keep these prices up forever?
Well, prices will continue dropping in terms of gold, right? There's no question that that's going to happen. But at some point, housing prices will begin to rise in terms of dollars. But that will simply mean that houses are losing value more slowly than dollars. And therefore, it looks like, you know, like if there's two people in a car and one car is going backwards 10 miles an hour and one car is going backwards at 25 miles an hour, if you look out the window, you could look like you're still going forwards, but you're actually going backwards. It's all relative. And so that's what's going to happen with houses. I mean, there's a huge glut of houses on the market, and we're still building more. So we're worsening the inventory imbalance. But you know what? There's a glut of dollars, and there's more of those being printed. So it's a question of, you know, which asset is going to lose value faster, a house or the dollar bill, you know?
Yeah. Can I ask you quickly about oil? Because I'm not sure where you are. I thought you were bearish on it. What's your feeling about oil right now?
No, I've been bullish for a long time. I mean, oil's, you know, crossed over $80 a barrel once again. I thought it could hit back to $100 a barrel before the end of this year. I've been predicting that. It doesn't look like, you know, we're going to get to 100 by the end of the year. It's still possible. You know, maybe we'll break into the 90s. But I certainly think by next year, in 2010, oil will be trading above $100 a barrel for most of that year, is my guess, and I ultimately head even higher than that. So I'm bullish on oil like I am on most commodities.
So do you like stocks like Exxon or BP? They pay dividends. Are they? Would you, even though Exxon,
well, look,
is an American
stock? Look, I personally own both those stocks. All right, I own them both. They're not my favorite oil stocks, and they're certainly not my best performers. In fact, you know, my foreign gold stocks, oil stocks in general, have done much better over my holding period. I've owned those stocks for years. All right. You know, I like oil stocks. Again, if you want, I try not to, for, you know, compliance reasons, I try not to, you know, get into specific stocks and stock advice on this program. If you really want to find out about the oil stocks that I like and the ones that we're buying for clients, you know, call up, you know, Euro Pacific Capital at 800-727-7922, and then and discuss it in private, you know, where, you know, your suitability factors can be taken into account.
Okay. Well, thanks, Peter. And I want to give a shout out to my girlfriend for recommending you to me. I have to give her credit for that. And
thank you.
Me onto that 2006 video is just amazing.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Thanks.
Yeah,
Peter.
And remember, you know, on a compliance end of it, you know, all the investment strategies that I discuss or I, you know, talk about on this show or reference, because I don't get into them in that much in particular, but of course, everything involves risk. Everything you do could result in losses. You know, the investments that we make can go down as well as up. You know that if you're a longtime listener to this program, if you're a client, you know, all the stocks that we were buying, by and large, got clobbered in 2008. So, you know, you've got to be willing to see losses in your accounts if you're going to consider investing in anything, particularly foreign stocks, foreign currencies, precious metals. But to get the information and to get the specifics, you really need to talk about it to a broker, you know, in private, off the air, at 800-727-7922. Next up is Julius in North Carolina.
Hey, Peter. How's it going?
Good. How are you?
All right. Actually, sort of to follow up on the last caller, about the real estate market and mortgages in particular, but after we're sort of through with this cycle, you know, you want to call it being through with it, but after Fannie and Freddie are sort of exposed, so to speak, about, like, all of their bad loans that are on their books and you know, if we go through a hyperinflationary scenario, what do you feel the future holds for them in terms of, like, are we going to see Uncle Bob from the Little League team starting to underwrite loans and holding them to maturity, or are we actually going to still see a secondary market, basically?
Well, I don't think right now, given the high level of home prices and the lax lending standards that still exist at government-owned entities such as Freddie and Fannie and FHA and all that, there are going to be no private mortgages. I mean, nobody is going to issue a mortgage that is not, you know, guaranteed by the government. It's just not going to happen because it's just too risky. So the entire mortgage market is now subsidized by the government. The mortgage market, the government is the mortgage market. Basically, anybody who buys a home in this country gets their financing from the U.S. government. And, of course, as long as that's happening, the economy is in serious, serious trouble. We need to return to a market-based mortgage system. But, of course, in a market-based mortgage system, the lenders are worried about losses. And so in that type of system, you have checks and balances. Home prices are lower. People are required to put up more money. People can only buy houses that they can afford. It's when you have the government running the mortgage market that people can overpay for houses and buy houses they can't afford. And so, you know, this has got to change, but right now it's not going to change because any move to a market-based mortgage market means lower home prices and means financial institutions that leveraged up and that bet heavily on real estate are going to go bankrupt. And that's something that the government right now is not willing to tolerate. So it's cheap money and, you know, print. And, you know, gold's going to keep going higher. The dollar's going to keep going lower. And the real economy is going to continue to suffer.
So what I'm trying to say is, like, after all of these events sort of transpire and, you know, perhaps the government says enough's enough, we have to, you know, turn off the printing presses or, you know, at some point, maybe there's a breaking point. Do you see that possibly ending and then going, you know, I understand that home prices will have to fall dramatically and interest rates would have to rise dramatically in order to remove the distortions that we already have or to sort of come to an equilibrium. But do you see that as a possibility?
Well, yes. I mean, that's the reason. One of the reasons I'm running for the United States Senate. I mean, hopefully we can have a real economy in this country once again. Otherwise, I mean, we're all going to have to pack up and look for another country to live in. So, yes, I am hopeful that we can eventually return capitalism to the American economy. But unfortunately, between now and then is going to be a lot of pain for a lot of people. And it's going to get more and more painful the more the government continues to pursue its current policy. You know, the policy that they're pursuing now is this economic stimulus, which is actually killing the economy. I mean, people think that, well, the consumer led us into this recession, and the consumer is going to lead us out. The consumer can't lead us out. It's because of all that excess consumer spending that the recession was necessary. The only real way to economic growth is going to be from the producer side. So the only way to have legitimate growth is through savings, production, and capital investment. That's what we need. But that's not what we're getting, because the government isn't allowing that to happen. There is no credit available for capital investment because it's all being spent by government. And nobody is saving money because people are spending. And so we're digging ourselves into this deeper hole, and we're making sure that there is no economic recovery anywhere in the horizon. All that's happening, when the politicians point to the GDP and they say, see, the economy is getting healthier, no, it's getting sicker, because all we're doing is goosing the GDP by going deeper into debt to buy more stuff. We are making the problem worse. We haven't even begun to solve the problem. We're still compounding it.
All right. Thanks a lot, Peter. That's all I really.
Well, thanks for the call. Thanks for the call. Next up, who's on the line the longest? Lewis in California.
Hey, Peter. It's Lewis, big fan and campaign contributor.
Thanks a lot. You know, I forget, but by far the largest number of contributions to my campaign have been coming in from California. So California is doing a great job of throwing the contributions. The rest of the states, we need you guys to pick up the pace, you know, and start making some contributions to start. I know California is a very popular state, so it's going to be hard to beat them numbers-wise, but maybe percentage-wise, because California is still contributing more to my campaign than they are to the population of the country. So the rest of us need to kick it up a notch to try to give California a run for its money.
good. And I plan to do more. But I like to watch your clips, your old school clips of when you appeared on Fox Business and all the shows over the last few years. And there's this one show you were on with Mike Norman and another guy with curly hair. And there's another guy you're on from the Ayn Rand Institute. And you're talking about, you know, you were saying there's only one inflation. And these guys were talking about, you know, and you're saying that oil's going up because of inflation. And the other guy made a point. He said, well, what if all of a sudden OPEC all got together and started to shut down production? Wouldn't that drive the price up? And you said it would, but then other prices would come down. Could you talk more about that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, the way markets work, absent an increase of money supply, right? If you have the same amount of money, let's say you have $100,
right?
And all of a sudden the price of something that you normally spend the whole $100 on every week you get $100, then you go out and you buy some stuff. If all of a sudden the price of one of the things that you were buying went up by, let's say, 50%, and you decided to buy it, and you paid the extra, right? Now, you know, if you're going to continue to buy the other goods, the only way you can keep buying them is if the prices are lower, because you simply don't have the extra money. The other vendors are not going to be able to charge the same amount of money if they want you to buy. So either they don't sell you the product at all, or they sell it to you at a lower price. But of course, if you had more money, then you could pay more money for everything. So what happens in general in a market economy is prices are always changing, right? Some prices go up, some prices go down, but the overall price level is going to remain constant relative to the supply of money that's out there. But what happens is, you know, OPEC raises their prices, and so the politicians decide to print more money so we can afford to pay those higher prices, and that's what causes the inflation. It's not that OPEC raised oil prices. It's that the Fed accommodated those higher oil prices by printing the new money to pay for it.
So not only is oil going up, everything else is going up too, nominally.
Exactly.
Right. Exactly. Okay. I got it. Okay. Thanks, Peter. That was it. I think you're doing a great job. Thank you.
All right, thanks. Thanks for the call. Next up, I keep hitting the wrong, my computer. Next up is Alan from Georgia. Go ahead, Alan.
Hi, Peter.
Hey, Alan. How are you?
I'm great. How are you doing?
Good.
I'm a big fan. I have both your books, Crash Proof and Crash Proof to you. I gave my girlfriend Crash Proof. Well, I watched all your videos. I do have a couple quick questions. They're sort of unrelated. One is charts. I've heard you talk about head and shoulders patterns and patterns like that, and I don't really know how that relates to the fundamentals. I know you're a real fundamental type of guy. You like dividends, you like profitable companies, you like growth industries. I'm just wondering, how does charts sort of play into that?
Well, charts kind of help you anticipate what the market might do in the short run based on technical patterns that are familiar. And there are some technical patterns that – you know, have proven to be reliable, not foolproof, but, you know, as a, you know, percentage or probability, pretty reliable. And like I mentioned earlier today, that I thought that the gold chart had broken out and we had just taken through some resistance and broke out to a new high. And generally, when you break out above a resistance level, you have some follow through. Because, you know, what happens there is you had some overhead resistance. There were sellers there. And the buying exhausted all that selling. And so the sellers that were there are no longer there because buying pushed through that resistance. And you would assume now that we don't have a lot of sellers around. We've cleaned those sellers out, and the market's going to have to move up to a new level to draw in new sellers. So I think you can use technical analysis. A head and shoulders pattern is generally a good reversal pattern. A head and shoulders top could mean that an upward trend is about to reverse down. A head and shoulders bottom would mean that a falling trend is about to reverse up. So I look at the technicals to kind of give me a better idea of what is happening in the market. But long run, I think those technical patterns are driven by the fundamentals, whether it's the fundamentals of the company or the fundamentals of the commodity. But sometimes if you just look at the technicals, you can get a pretty good idea of what's going to happen without understanding those fundamentals. But basically, it's, you know, the fundamentals. Now, of course, for short periods of time, like when we had the internet mania and the dot-com bubble, there were plenty of reliably bullish technical patterns that meant prices were going to rise. And, of course, that was happening despite the fundamentals because it was a mania. But absent, you know, stock market manias, in general, the technicals will reflect the underlying fundamentals.
Okay, I understand what you're saying. My other question is, I didn't even know, I saw your father as a fan of Irwin, and I was a big fan of Ron Paul. And at the time, I hadn't even heard of you. And then I heard of you one day, and I found out Irwin was actually your father. And you're actually an advisor for Ron Paul, which was hilarious. But and I find that one trend between you, like, and Jim Rogers and others like you, everyone's looking at gold, foreign stocks, and commodities. And I was just wondering, how do these compare to each other? Like, I know gold is obviously a big inflation play. I'm wondering, how do commodities and stocks fit in there? And, like,
my feeling is that of those three asset classes, I think gold is the relative safest. I look at gold as simply money, as liquidity. And so I think that just owning physical gold is what you could do, you know, if you want to be relatively safer in that respect. And then the other asset classes, I think then, you know, individual commodities would be next. But there's no yield and no return there. So by definition, they're a little bit more speculative in that the only way you're going to make money in commodities is if the price of the asset goes up. On the other hand, you can buy foreign stocks that pay good dividends, and you'll make a good return even if the price of the stock never changes, because you collect a dividend. Also, by buying foreign stocks, you're able to get out of the U.S. dollar. But, of course, you take the risk that something will deteriorate in the company. The stock could go down in value. In an extreme case, the stock could go bankrupt. So there is risk involved in owning equities. You get that risk regardless of, you know, whether you own a foreign equity or a domestic equity. But there are all various ways to try to enhance your wealth or preserve your wealth. And I think the key is looking for ways to get out of U.S. currency. See, that is what very few people seem to appreciate in this country, is how risky the dollar is. And when I alluded to this earlier in the show with Rubini, but I hear it all the time. People talk about, you know, whenever the market's going up, it's like, oh, people are moving into the risk trade. And whenever the market goes down and the dollar goes up, well, they're taking risk off the table. Everybody looks at the dollar as the safest assets in the world. And the minute you step away from the dollar, they assume you're taking greater risk. That is still the wrong way to look at it. The risk is in the dollar. And what you can do to get out of the dollar, I believe, diminishes your real risk. And so you've just got to find different ways to do that.
Okay, I gotcha. But one quick question. I have other callers waiting on the line. This is the only one I don't really understand this.
China. By the way, yeah, no more calls coming. I've got three people on hold in only 7 minutes.
It might take a second. I understand China's everyone's like saying, you know, China needs us for our demand, and I understand that's total nonsense. I mean, China can probably use up everything that China produces. But I'm wondering, when the dollar falls, and like with your forecast, I don't really have any questions about your forecast. I know they're right.
Hey, you got to ask your question in the next 10 seconds, otherwise I gotta let you go.
When the dollar falls, why won't China get poorer when all the its reserves
because China's dollar reserves are you know, they're substantial, but they have a lot more RMB than they have dollars, you know. And what's going to happen? And China also has a lot of gold, and the key is going to be purchasing power. China's going to take a loss on all their dollars, but I think the RMB will increase in purchasing power dramatically, maybe fivefold or more. Which means even though they're going to have fewer RMB, if you think about the fact that, okay, those dollars have a certain renminbi value, and now they're going to lose that value. So even though they'll have fewer RMB, the ones that they have are going to give them much more purchasing power, and they're going to be better off. You know, you can think about the flip side. Americans are going to have a lot more dollars. The average, you know, the average homeless person could be a millionaire, right? He could be loaded up with dollars, but he's not going to be able to buy anything because the dollar is going to have very little value. So the Chinese are going to lose some of their money, but their money is going to gain a lot of value. We're going to get a lot more money that has a lot less value. So they're going to be much better off. They're going to have a higher standard of living. They're going to be able to buy a lot more. And we're going to get screwed despite the fact that we can all be swimming in paper money. Anyway, thanks a lot for your call, Alan.
Appreciate it.
Next up is Sean in Michigan. Go ahead, Sean.
Hey, Peter. From my understanding, for the 1920s, there wasn't such a large scale for stocks. And I was just wondering what your thoughts are on kind of government intervention, kind of encouraging this kind of culture where people are more involved in owning stocks and they don't have so much direct oversight over the companies and the managers.
Well, I definitely think the big change between, you know, back then, you know, and now is that, you know, the guys that really, you know, run the companies hardly own any stock. You know, back in the 20s or 30s, the people that founded these companies, you know, owned the majority of the shares. And they and their families lived off the dividends. So their interests were really aligned with all the other shareholders. So they did a very good job of managing the companies for the benefit of the shareholders. Plus, they knew that their children or their, you know, were going to inherit these shares. And so they really cared about the company. Today, companies are run by people who barely own any shares. And the shares that they get, you know, they get them in stock options. And as soon as they die, so they're all short-term traders. And you also have the average American now. He doesn't own the share himself, so he doesn't vote the proxy. The shares are owned by mutual funds, and these guys don't give a damn because it's not their money. So I think you have a lot of people who are involved in these companies, and it's not even their money. And so I think it was much better when the shareholders was more involved with his money than it is today. And I think if the government really got out of the way and pulled all these moral hazards, I think that we would go more and more back to a more responsible oversight on the part of shareholders. And we would put executives in these companies that own stock.
You kind of compare it to deposit insurance.
Yeah, well, the deposit insurance, again, I said many times, deposit insurance is what has ruined the banking industry because it's created a moral hazard. Nobody cares how risky their banks are with their money because the government guarantees all the accounts. The banks know this, so the banks have no incentive to play it safe. All of them are gambling. And so there's so much risk in the system because of the government guaranteeing the accounts. Whenever the government puts in a guarantee, everybody behaves in a much more riskier way than they would have in a free market without the guarantee, and that's the problem. Anyway, I got to let you go. I got one more call in 3 more minutes. Robert, last call of the night in California.
Hi, Peter. Thanks for taking my call. I'm a new listener. And the question I had real quickly was if you could comment on deflationary pressures versus inflationary pressures.
Sure. Whenever you have an inflationary boom, all right, it's going to be followed by a deflationary bust. And that is what happens. But the government doesn't like the deflation. They like the inflation. The inflation is when it's fun. That's when the assets are going up in value. All the voters are happy. The deflation is when people lose money. Asset prices fall. The recession comes in. The politicians hate that. So they want to fight that off. Under a gold standard, they can't fight it off, really. I mean, they can try, but it's very difficult. But when there's no gold standard, they can print all this money. They can keep fighting off deflation with inflation. And eventually, the government wins because they can print money indefinitely. They can drop it out of helicopters. And that's what a lot of people don't understand, that the biggest inflations in history are preceded by deflations. And what happens is, but the government won't let the deflation because it's too politically painful. So they do whatever they can to stop it. And, you know, they end up with massive inflation instead. But you still end up with a deflationary bust. You just can't see it because of all the inflation. But if you measure prices in gold, you'll always see it. And that's what's going on. If you look at gold at $1,100 an ounce, that means prices for other things like houses, like stocks, are falling when you measure them in gold. And prices for consumer goods are falling. There is a deflation going on in gold. But, of course, in the money that we're dropping from helicopters, you can't see it because the money is losing value faster than the stuff. Anyway, that's it for today. Thanks. I'm glad to have you as a new listener. Make sure to tune in next week. Anyway, running out of time. Don't forget Money Bomb tomorrow, shiftforsenate.com. Give what you can. Let's see what we can raise. And also, don't forget, watch me on Glenn Beck tomorrow night. And if you haven't, pick up a copy of Crash Proof 2.0, How to Profit from the Economic Collapse. That's it this week. This has been Peter Schiff at Euro Pacific Capital. This has been another episode of Wall Street Unspun. Be back again next Wednesday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. So long, everyone.